And I'll be driving this vehicle, so you don't have to worry about anything.
Cool. I thought you were about to say I'm going to do the show driving.
I'm driving right now.
I'm stuck in LA traffic.
I probably could do a show that way.
No.
No, not really. No. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. I am Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California, and with me today I have friend of the show, Ashley Hitchcock, who's never been on. You're a first-timer.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here and finally tell you what I think.
you're one of the minority of my friends who actually listen to the show.
Yeah, which surprises me, because I think it's really entertaining, and you either have Keith Foster or Richard on, which I just think it's fun to hear my friends talk.
Mm-hmm. So, see, that was always my argument for the people who don't listen. I was like, you know, yeah, I'm not there in town hanging out with you, but you can kind of sort of listen to what's going on in my life every week.
That's true.
Or, you know, at a point in time, it was every week. Less so nowadays.
Yeah.
And this episode, we'll be catching up because of another few weeks off. So we'll be talking about Moana, the new Disney film. I'm going to review Nocturnal Animals. And together, we're going to review Rogue One, A Star Wars Story.
Mm-hmm.
You and your boyfriend, Cade, I was going to say that's how we know each other, but it's not. Me and you used to work together at the video store, back in my video store days.
That's right.
K&B Video Represent.
Yeah, and you just happened to be friends with Cade as well, who I also met at the video store and then seduced him into dating me.
Right, exactly.
A lot happened at the video store.
That was a very seminal period of, I think, both of our lives.
Yeah.
I think everybody kind of has this romantic feeling of their shitty minimum wage job. It was so entertaining, and everybody there was such a character, and it should be a show. Like, I'm working now at a shitty minimum wage job, retail position, and every once in a while I'll have conversations with my friends there, and they're always like, this should be a show. We could do a show.
I agree. I think I would love to do a show about K&B Video. And I think that they do give some of the best material because they're depressing and you have to find the humor in that. Mm-hmm. It's way better than, I mean, because you have like this influx of customers coming in, like at my other office, at my last job, there's just like 10 of us there all day. And yeah, we had mm-hmm. fun, but like that would be so boring to watch. It's really like
The Office, right? That would be more like,
yeah, I guess
The
you're Office. Because right. I was thinking Clerks. Clerks is the perfect representation of what a video stop movie would be. Like that would be, I think that would be hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, one could say that kind of already went there, but that ground has already been covered by Kevin Smith. But no, it was certainly a big part of my life, a big part of the reason why I ended up in LA. In some regards, because working around movies all day and being encouraged to talk about them all day sort of headed me into the direction of turning film criticism into, you know, from a hobby to an actual career goal, which might have been a mistake. I'll let you know.
Yeah. In 20 years.
In 20 years.
We'll definitely know in 20 years.
I think we'll definitely know in 5 years.
Maybe.
I think, yeah, 3 to 5 years. If I'm recording this podcast from my parents' house, then we know. you started a new job, kind of, sort of, recently. Like, we're talking over Skype. We're doing this because you're recording from Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And you just started a Skype-centric job teaching English as a second language to Chinese kids.
That's right. Yeah, that started last night.
Last night was your first night.
Oh, yeah, technically early this morning. I had a class that started at 2 a.m. So remember, Beijing is 16 hours ahead from Pacific time zone. So at 2 a.m. for me, it's like 6 p.m. for them. So they're done with school for the day. Their parents log them on to this program, and I get on there and I teach them a couple of words in English and a couple of sight words and alphabet letters and stuff like that. Yeah.
And how did it go? Were you too tired to even like think correctly, or were you up for it?
I had stayed up really late the night before until like 4 a.m. So the next day when I was supposed to be staying up really late to teach these classes, oh my gosh, I was so stressed out and I was so grumpy and tired that I was so anxious that was going to come across when I turned on the camera. But once the kid is there and is on the screen, and like, you just put on this character and you put on this facade and you're like, hello, my name's Ashley. And, and you totally just dive into it. You don't even have time to think about how tired you are. So I stayed up until like 6 a.m. and then went to bed, and I have to do that again tonight. And yeah, so that's going to take some getting used to for me. I'm not a night owl and that hardcore.
Well, you're about to be that hardcore.
Yeah.
How is these kids' English? Like,
it really ranges, because the age range is from 5 to 12. So they might know no English whatsoever, but it's a full immersion class. So I don't need to know any Chinese, which is cool. Anyone can do this job if they just have a bachelor's degree. And so the 12-year-olds, obviously, if they've been keeping up with it and they've been enrolled for a few years, they're going to be able to read full paragraphs pretty easily and talk with you.
But was it difficult, like with the ones who are younger? I don't know what students you had or where their age range was, or their
they're pretty young. They were like 6. Of English. Yeah, they were like 6.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would think that, you know, full immersion or not, if they don't know anything, it would just make the class very difficult.
I think so. I think it's a whole different challenge, because I do have teaching experience with kids, but they speak English and we were in a classroom together. So you have to deal with keeping their attention on this little video screen when they've gone to class all day already. And so they kind of don't want to like do more school. And so you have to keep their attention. Plus, you just have to figure out new ways to communicate with them over that screen because of that barrier that you have physically. And then, yeah, you also have to get really creative in how you're going to explain how to do something to them. So you use a lot of body language. So you're like, can you circle the F? And you have to speak really slowly.
Do they encourage a specific kind of accent, like no slang, try to use every syllable? Like,
oh, yeah.
Kind of
yeah. You need to speak wonderful English. Like, yeah, you can't have an accent at all. They just want like a purely like North American accent, sort of. If you lived in London, you speak English, but you have an accent and they're worried about you passing that on to the child. And so, yeah, they're pretty particular in who they hire, just for, you know, having a bachelor's and having an accent.
That's interesting, because you would think like English would be like the universal standard across the world, seeing as they were the first to use the language and we're the ones that actually kind of muddied it up.
Mm-hmm.
Like we hear, you know, Midwestern English or whatever is basically just like a pure English. But people from England hear it as, like, rednecky and annoying.
Yeah.
Probably, I would assume. I don't know.
They just use an entirely different lingo. Like, they call the garbage can bins, like, throw it in the bin. Or they I don't know. So they have totally different words for different things. So I wonder if that, and I mean, you know, they, Chinese people are really interested in American culture, and they're interested in America as a place that they want to come and visit someday. So they need to know the lingo and the vocabulary for this country, not London, as a significantly smaller country, the UK.
No, yeah, I mean, it just speaks to the fact that America's superpower
Yeah, I didn't want to say that. I didn't want to sound like a dick. Saying America's the best.
Nothing dickish about it. It's just that it is what it is. Like, the fact that, you know, that American English is the standard that's being taught is, you know, indicative of our, I guess, our place as a world power.
I agree.
But we're not here to talk about that. we're here to talk about movies, and it's going to be kind of a, like I told you before, kind of a skeletal show. We'll talk a little bit about what we're watching on Netflix at the end, but let's start here with Disney's Moana.
Moana.
Which I told you at the beginning of the show, I was calling Mona for the longest time until somebody corrected me. And this is directed by Ron Clements and Don Hall. And it's based upon an ancient Peloponnesian story, sort of a creation myth of sorts of the islands around in and around Hawaii. Aoi? Am I pronouncing that right? Aoi?
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't have even gone there.
You wouldn't have even gone there?
No, I would have just been like, yeah, they found this young 15, 16-year-old girl to have an authentic Polynesian voice to play Moana, but I can't say her name.
Right. I maybe should have looked it up or something. But it's kind of a different take on the Disney princess thing. And Moana is a chieftress to be. After her father passes away, she'll be the next in succession to take over her island. And, but she, in the tradition of the Disney princess, she seeks bigger, greater things. And there's kind of been like this, ban as far as like what happens, outside of the current, immediate, current that's around their island. They're not allowed to go past it. So it's kind of a Lion King thing going on there.
Yeah.
Stay
in your own territory.
Right, which if you know that, you know, if that's announced at the first third of the movie, you know that eventually they're going to travel out and see what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to after a blight comes upon their island and all of their crops are dying and they're no longer able to catch any fish. And that leads Moana out to go find the home for this magical stone that ended up on washing on shore and choosing her as a young princess to be, and she has to return it in order to stop an evil darkness from coming over her land. On the way, she runs into Dwayne Johnson, I can pronounce his name, Maui, who's a little bit like, I'm feeling like some Robin Williams, Aladdin genie vibes.
Really?
Off of him. Which is to say that I think there's a lot of kind of Disney's greatest hits going on in this movie. But he's hanging out with her, and he has his own goals because he lost his magic hook that allows him to transform into different animals. And, you know, together they have to defeat a giant evil black darkness, which may have its own kind of twist endings and surprises. I know you were pretty stoked on Moana, as is everybody right now. Moana is still doing really well in the box office, and I think it speaks a lot to John Lasseter, who used to be the head producer over at Pixar for a really long time, and I guess he still has a lot of involvement over there. But lately, over the last original Disney films, he's been seeing over a lot more of the Disney proper animation. And I think bringing a lot of, like, what Pixar used to do in their heyday over to the Disney properties. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think this is kind of a rejuvenation. We had a Tangled, and that was a pretty good film, but I think, like, they're really mm-hmm. coming into their own again, and this is kind of a renaissance of Disney a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly Frozen was a massive
yes.
hit.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, especially when it comes to the music in this movie, I think I wrote something like they're trying to out Frozen with the song selection here.
Yeah.
And isn't, if I'm not wrong, isn't the one of the key songwriters here the guy who composed Hamilton, the play?
That's right. His name is Lin-Manuel Miranda, and he wrote definitely a few songs. I don't know if it was the majority of the score or not, but he wrote some of the big songs, and he even sang the main song. When she finally takes sail in her little boat, that's like he sings that entire song through that entire montage.
Hmm. Okay. So how did you feel about Moana?
I loved it. And I had seen trailers for it, and I was looking forward to it. I was going to give it a chance, but I could already tell that it was going to be well received and it was going to be a positive outcome. So I saw it over Thanksgiving with some friends, and there were times when we kind of all teared up a bit because the relationship that she has with her grandma and her parents is a healthy, encouraging one. So, I mean, my biggest note about Moana is that I love that Disney is really focusing on feminism and moving away from the stereotype of Cinderella and Snow White, these women that need to be saved or rescued and then need to find a man, fall in love, and get married. That's not anyone's goal in Disney anymore. It's in Frozen, it's about finding yourself and accepting you who you are for your faults or not. And Moana's about her becoming a chief for her land one day and her people. And that's wonderful because I know that I know some Polynesians and Hawaiians were like, well, that would never happen. It would never be a woman that would take over as chief. And I'm like, obviously they're making a creative decision here to explore what that would be like for a young woman to, you know, if your parents had only girls, you'd be the next chief. And I think it's a huge compliment that she is growing up to become that. And it's not a romantic story. It's not about her being saved by Maui, the Dwayne Johnson character. It's about her actually rescuing her entire land and the people.
Right. Yeah. So again, it gives her more, stakes in the actual plot.
Yeah.
Than just a passive thing to be rescued or what have you.
Yeah, because Dwayne Johnson's character is like a demigod. Like, he has magical powers. He has, like, this unbeatable strength, like physical strength. And yet she, like, rescues him in some instances of the plot where he's, like, struggling. And he's like, right. Oh my God, a mere mortal was able to assist me. Like, he's taken aback.
Yeah, I like the movie quite a bit, and I think it goes down pretty easily. It's structured pretty well, I think the animation is absolutely gorgeous. Yeah. I saw it in 2D. Did you?
I saw it in 3D. Although I think I would have liked to have seen it in 2D because sometimes the 3D seemed dark or just not what I wanted. I don't know. It was weird.
Yeah, I mean, I could see the potential for 3D. I see what shots or whatever they were probably designed specifically to enhance 3D. Mm-hmm. But I enjoyed it plenty well in 2D. I think water is kind of an easy thing to do with this style of animation, and they're getting better and better at doing it.
Yeah.
The production design and a lot of kind of the look of the movie and sort of the aesthetic choices. I think are all really beautiful and pleasing, and also kind of reminds me of a lot of like the look and kind of the feel of Little Mermaid in some places, aesthetically. And I think like, you know, Dwayne Johnson, like his whole body is covered in like these animated tattoos that have a personality of their own.
That's fun.
And they kind of reflect what he's feeling or, you know, what he's thinking. Like, the tattoos will start, like, dancing around or moving or going from one part of his body to another. That was fun. I think my biggest issue with it is Moana as a character, you know, it's funny that you point out that, you know, she's not a passive character and that she has more agency in the plot. And that's true. I think almost maybe to a fault. I think as a character, she seems to be serving mostly as a plot function than she does as a living, breathing human being.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I know what her goals are, and I know that where those goals have to fit in her story. But, there's a little bit there about, like, she's a chosen one. So, you know, it's Disney, and that's a fairly easy trope to lean on. So there's that, and then on top of it, we know that she loves her grandma, and she knows that we know that she wants to save her land. But other than that, there's not a lot of character moments between even her and Maui. I think Maui gets a little bit more because he's kind of based upon comedic relief more than anything else. But I never get much from her other than determination. And I felt like, as you know, obviously the movie's also a musical, so a lot of her like innermost thoughts or whatever is going to come out in the numbers and the songs.
Right.
But I still felt a little disconnected from her as a character, other than as a cipher function through the plot.
Well, I think as a daughter of a chief, you are already a chosen one because you will be the chief, and so for a young girl of like 15 or 16 in this day and age to have that much responsibility on her shoulders, I think she already has to have this kind of different, more mature, selfless mindset. It's all, the whole movie is about her being selfless because she's doing it for other people. So I think that's a strong character point. And then, you know, being chosen for saving the people as well as being the chief to the people when she gets back. The whole movie is about her being this, having this important role that it demands selflessness. And so what would you want differently? What would you want them to include to make her a more well-rounded character and not just a plot device?
I would like a few scenes of characters having conversations that's other than about what's going on in the movie, other than what's the plot.
I see.
I would like to know a little bit more about what makes her tick. And given, you know, a few scenes, like there's a little bit of sort of an Odyssey episodic thing going on here with the way that the story is laid out. And there's a few twists and turns that are like, there's a, at one point they run into these coconut, like these mini coconut pirates. that scene just kind of comes and goes and is never referred to again. You could almost cut that scene out of the movie completely and it would make no difference. And like, if they're going to make those kind of divergences, you know, there's another point when he's actually, you know, when Maui's getting his hook, they run into Jermaine Clements, who's voicing this giant singing crab, who's doing his best Tim Curry impression, like, you know, Ferngully kind of thing. And it's a fun number, and I like the sort of the neon look of that scene and everything, the kind of blacklight neon look. But like, if they're gonna take these divergences, it would be nice to give the characters a few moments to see how they're, to check in with them emotionally during these scenes.
Yeah, I can respect that.
Not just what their function is in the scene as far as what do they need to achieve to get to the next scene, but where are they, like, how does she feel about this? And, you know, it's not that big of a problem as far as in the world of Disney movies go. It works relatively fine. But I had a hard time falling in love with the movie. And I think for me, a lot of that was because of sort of the surface level nature of a lot of it. And then some of it was just because some of the beats were so familiar from other Disney movies.
Yeah. Well, you gotta, you know, if it ain't broken.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think we reviewed the live action remake of Jungle Book a little while ago when that came out. And that was, you know, my beef. Well, I don't even know if it was a beef, but I made the observation that there was a whole lot of Lion King going on in that remake.
Oh,
too.
For sure. It's like exactly the plot of Lion King. Yeah. That's fun.
But yeah, so I recommend Moana. I think that it's a good time in the theaters, and I think the music for me is really the standout. I think it's been a long time since we've had a really good Disney musical. And they've tried, and you know, certainly Let It Snow or whatever. What was that called? Let It Go was a big hit, and people still kind of hum that, and it, you know, it's sort of a meme. But I prefer the music here, and I think it's a little bit more creative and a little less like Disney pop.
Yeah.
And I think bringing in the Hamilton guy was probably a good choice to kind of put some new blood into the mix.
Yeah, I think I praise Disney for trying to expand the race and the color of skin that their characters can have. You know, we had Lilo and Stitch, which is Hawaiian, but that's not really, it's not about Hawaiian culture or anything. It's just about this like alien. And, you know, and then we have like Mulan and we have Pocahontas, but you know, like all the other princesses are white, aren't they?
I mean, Jasmine.
Oh, Jasmine
is Arabian. Yes, that's so right. What was that? Princess and the Frog. They tried.
Oh, right. That She's African American.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they've off and on they've kind of played around with like changing the location or the cultural specificity.
Yeah.
There's a lot of Mulan going on in this movie as well. I forgot that one.
I think I would like if, you know, just because the Princess and the Frog exists and they have an African-American princess character, I don't want them to just be like, okay, well, we have our token black person, so now we'll do a white princess or whatever. Like, I want them to continue to really expand that and be mindful of that. I think that's the way to go. And, and as well as like Moana's like body, she has a curvier structure and, she has like normal sized arms and legs. So I know they made a conscious decision to give her a real figure and not a tiny Elsa figure with like giant eyes.
Well, specifically, Disney got a lot of flack before Frozen came out and romanced the country. There was a bunch of articles being written about how Disney had a problem with being able to design women because basically they just took the exact same character design from Tangled and put new hair on it.
Yeah.
when it comes to the women, but when it came to the men, they had all different shapes and sizes.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting.
So they maybe took that note and applied it here.
Yeah. Yeah, I know they spent a couple of years in the South Pacific, kind of learning the culture and, drawing and designing these things. And so it's not perfect. It's trying to give like a generalization of like the Polynesian culture. Overall, I think that's great that they're inclusive and trying to work on different body shapes and sizes. Like Maui, for example, like he's not fat. He's just pure muscle and he's giant. Like the Rock.
Yeah, I mean it's not a realistic body form, obviously, but the character sort of allows for some amount of mythos. That's why I compare him a lot to
the genie.
The genie.
He does have that structure, kind of the big arms and cross.
Yeah, and he's very animated, not obvious like computer animated, but like he's very he moves a lot and his actions speak almost as much as what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course he's transforming all the time and he doesn't do like impression machine, but there is a lot going on there that he functions in a very similar way.
Yeah, I can see that.
Okay. Well, that was Moana. And, I'm going to move on and talk a little bit about Nocturnal Animals, the new film by Tom Ford, the fashion designer. He did a film a few years ago, which I really liked, starring Colin Firth called, A Single Man. Did you happen to catch that?
No.
It was kind of it was like a character piece. It was pretty small. It was just about Colin Firth, who was a closeted,
I remember it. Gay, yeah.
You remember when it came out. Yeah. He was a closeted gay professor who, just lost his partner and he was trying to kind of move on with his life. But I thought that Tom Ford, given the subject matter, which is pretty straightforward, brought in a lot of expressiveness to that visually.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing as he's a fashion designer and he thinks visually anyway, that makes a lot of sense, especially when it comes to the movie's color palette and, the way he frames in particular shots. And he seemed to make the emotional reality of his characters mirror the physical reality of what's going on screen. So there's a lot of like internal resonance with the way that he visualizes cinema. And I thought, that was a really strong first feature. Story-wise, it didn't give him a lot of breathing room, but I thought that, certainly he's a talent to look out for in the world of film. He's already, fairly famous in the world of fashion.
Yeah.
So I was excited to see what he would do with a crime thriller, which is one of my favorite genres, here with Nocturnal Animals. which he adapted from a Austin Wright novel. And we have this very kind of complex story. I actually knew very little about this novel or what the story was even going to be when I went in to see the movie. So a lot of it kind of came as a surprise. But Amy Adams plays this sort of rich, dispossessed L.A. socialite named Susan Morrow, who's married to Armie Hammer, a younger man named Houghton Morrow. And he's cheating on her, and she knows, but they're so kind of rich and blasé and so above it that there's sort of an understanding that they're in a loveless marriage and of convenience, and she's, you know, making a lot of money by staying with him, so whatever. So he goes on a quote-unquote business trip while she's at home in her giant glass castle on the top of Hollywood Hills. And she's an art curator, I don't know, like museum curator or something like that. At the beginning of the movie, which I think is really going to like weed out the type of people who might not be in for this kind of movie experience, like within the first 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
The beginning of the movie is this, these long, slow motion tableaus of these very old and morbidly obese women dancing naked.
What?
While like glitter is falling from the sky like rose petals over them.
Oh dear.
And then cutting to these different kinds of close up body shots of, you know, different parts of their bodies flowing like water on the screen. And it goes on for a while. It lingers, this montage. Until it reveals that this is actually an art exhibition that Amy Adams' character is working on, and she goes home, and we find out about her soap opera issues back at her mansion. While Armie Hammer is away, she gets a manuscript from her ex, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, who wrote a novel called Nocturnal Animals, and leaves it with a note. She hasn't seen this ex in a long time. Leaves it with a note that says, This story is inspired by our past relationship. I would have never been able to write this had I not met you. So she begins to read the novel, and then the movie goes into the text and visualizes what she's reading as a movie within the movie.
Wow.
And the movie within the movie is this kind of Western noir crime thriller that could have easily been made by somebody like the Coen brothers. Or something like that. And it's actually a fairly stylistically a huge departure from what we've seen already. Ford presents this kind of LA, rich person dispossession in this sort of cold, sterile, I described in my reviews, very kind of Cronenberg-ish, look at, you know, the sort of, one percenter malaise. And then once we get into the gritty crime thriller, it's very gritty. The camera work's different. It's not as held as still. The shots are not as deliberate. It seems like he's going more for kind of a realistic handheld kind of thing. Jake Gyllenhaal also plays the main character within his other character's book. And he's married to Isla Fisher, who are traveling through the West in a move, and him and his teenage daughter and his wife get in a car accident with a group of redneck ruffians. Aaron Taylor Johnson, the guy who played Kick-Ass,
mm-hmm.
He plays the leader of this redneck gang who pushes them off the road and then proceeds to sort of psychologically torture them. Saying he's going to let them go. Maybe he'll help them fix their car. But if they're going to help him fix their car, then they have to get in. His wife and his daughter have to get in their car. What ends up happening is he loses his wife and daughter to this gang. And he's kind of a weak man. The story that he's written is he's written this character, maybe possibly a version of himself or a version of his own insecurities. Or his worst insecurities about his masculinity, he writes it in the form of this other Jake Gyllenhaal character who is unable to protect his wife and daughter from these these bandits, as you will. And then it jumps a little bit ahead in that story, I guess the novel story. And Jake Gyllenhaal enlists the help of Michael Shannon, who plays a rogue sheriff who's going to help him get revenge. And he has his own reasons for why the law might not matter so much to him anymore. So Michael Shannon's character essentially represents all of the roughness and Western masculinity that Jake Gyllenhaal doesn't feel that he possesses himself. And where does morals come into that? And I think we're supposed to take this story within the story, and it cuts back and forth from her, like, you know, Amy Adams reading the story and her kind of trying to live her normal life, knowing, you know, and also it cuts into flashback of her and Gyllenhaal's relationship when she was much more young and idealistic and had just moved from the South to learn about art and culture away from her conservative parents, who she doesn't want to be compared to. And so there's a lot of story going on in this story.
Yeah.
And I think my biggest problem with the movie, which I admire a lot, but I can't get behind, is that ultimately it doesn't say a ton with any of this. I think we're supposed to kind of compare, you know, what's going on symbolically between the story that Gyllenhaal wrote and the story that's going on in the framing device plot. And I think, you know, there's some kind of weird misogyny going on in the subtext here that I'm not sure is 100% intentional. Or maybe it is, I'm not sure. And then on B, it comes off as a little trite. Once you connect the dots between that plot and the other plot, it doesn't actually feel like it's saying that much, given how much narrative hoops we're jumping through to get to it. I think that Tom Ford is still an incredibly talented visualist, and I really enjoy a lot of the individual shots. I actually think that this little movie in the middle, the little movie within the movie, had that had just been the only movie, it would have been simple and it would have been pretty stock genre stuff,
right?
Revenge movie stuff, but he was doing that really well. And I think that if he wanted to go that direction in his career, he definitely could. As far as the overall combination of all these different story elements, it comes up as a little up its own ass a lot of the time.
Right.
And not nearly as profound or as resonant as it thinks it's being. I think that Amy Adams does a good job at playing super icy and distant and cold in this movie. He shoots her with, you know, this black eyeliner that's like painted raccoon-like on her face and this bright red lipstick, and she's kind of looks bloodless, like a vampire through most of the movie. And there's something about that look that I really like on her. Yeah, I don't know. I kind of don't know what to do with this movie. I think it's...
Still don't know how to feel about it.
No, you know, there's a lot of it, especially with the opening montage, and that's how I thought, this will surely come back around. Not really. The only thing that I could kind of see is that, you know, Ford certainly has an interest in aesthetics, and he certainly has an interest in sort of comparing, the gorgeous to the grotesque. And if you look at the visual styles of both the story and that Gyllenhaal wrote and the framing device story, he kind of juxtaposes those in a similar way. But, you know, so I think in a way he's a lot more interested with the visual potential of the movie than he is with the story potential, even though the movie proposes to be all about why we make art and why we tell stories. Mm-hmm. I don't think he has very good answers for either of those questions.
Wow.
But it's all right. Yeah, I don't know. See it or not. Buyer beware. Let's talk Star Wars.
Cool.
Do you want to describe this one? What happens in Star Wars what is it called? Rogue One, A Star Wars Story.
Rogue Nation. I can't explain it. Well, I can explain some of it, but I'm not going to explain it because I you know that I fell asleep through like an hour of it.
A full hour? I thought it was just like a half an
hour. No, no, no. Like, okay, so I'm going to start explaining it, and then you can fill in the holes.
Okay.
Okay, so we start in this, like, farmland, and it's this dad and mother and their child, this little girl who ends up being the main character. And her name is, I don't know what her name is. Jin?
Jin?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's just her little family of three in this farmland. And, you know, like some bad guys come and they want to take the dad back because I guess he was in charge of making weapons.
The Death Star.
Yeah. He was in charge of making weapons before they made the Death Star. So they like forced him to go and build the Death Star. So they kidnap him, but they also wanted to kidnap the daughter, but she's able to get away. And then Forrest Whitaker's character, like, comes and saves her and rescues her. Then we jump forward in the present, like 15 years or something. And she is in prison and I have no idea why. And she gets rescued by the Alliance or whatever. Right. And
the rebels.
And they're like, we want you to, you know, kind of help us find Forrest Whitaker's character so that he can help us find your father so that we can figure out how to destroy this Death Star because they're going to kill us all. So they're like, if you do all of this, we'll let you go from your prison sentence or whatever. And she's like, okay, great. So they start on that journey. And, you know, from there, like, honestly, I don't exactly know what happened. I just know the ending. So why don't you take it over from here?
Yeah, no, that pretty much covers it. you know, I was getting actually echoes of Inglourious Basterds with the opening. Do you remember that?
I've never seen that movie.
You never saw Inglourious Basterds? Okay, shoot. Well, but that movie opens a very similar way where Nazis come in and to a French farm and the wife and daughter are hiding underneath the floorboards while Christoph Waltz's character is trying to intimidate the father. And then the daughter ends up escaping and she ends up being, you know, this main character who has to take down the Nazis at the end.
Wow, so this is basically the same movie. They literally copied Inglourious Basterds. That's exactly the plot.
It's very similar, yes. But not nearly as interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like I could say almost the same things I said about Moana here, except for I think that this movie suffers a lot more from it. Who is this girl?
I know, right? Like, I have no idea why she's in prison at the beginning. I'm like, what has she done? Like,
I think we're led to believe, and I'll admit right here, I was so not in the mood to see it when I saw it. I was just got off of work. I had one opportunity to see it before recording this, and I needed to see it before I had write my review. I was kind of vaguely excited about it because I like the idea of them doing these kind of tangential side stories that are outside of the canon, outside of like the larger trilogy stuff.
Right.
I kind of like the idea of like this and expanded universe Star Wars mythos has been around for years. There's a million novels that's been written
and little cartoons about the Clone Wars and all that stuff.
Right. Yeah. And comic books. You know, Dark Horse has been writing them forever.
Right.
To kind of fill in these gaps. There's been video games made. So expanded, like Star Wars, like, really started the boom on expanded universe. And so it makes sense that they would start doing it with their movies, especially now that everything has to be a movie universe. So I was kind of excited to see what this would be. Gareth Edwards directed it, who also directed a small sci-fi indie called Monsters. It was his first film, starring Scoot McNairy. And then later he did the remake of Godzilla a couple years ago, which I had mixed feelings on as well. And I feel like, I don't know. It's weird because I saw this movie. I watched it with my eyeballs. but I feel like I still haven't seen it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I feel like I saw a 2-hour trailer for a movie.
That's hilarious because I slept through a lot of it and I woke up and knew exactly what had happened. I knew the entire plot of that movie and I missed like an hour of it.
It is kind of dull. And, you know, there is a aspect to it that it's trying to be dark. And I think that is by far the darkest Star Wars movie made.
It's depressing at the end.
There is absolutely no lip service here to the fact that this is a kids franchise.
Uh-huh.
other than there's like a sassy robot.
Right.
That's about the only comedic relief that we have here.
It's Alan Tudyk's voice, isn't it? He's also in Moana, so we got Alan Tudyk.
Yeah, Alan Tudyk. Friend of the podcast, Alan Tudyk. Yeah, he does a voice of the sassy robot, and then that's probably my favorite character.
Yeah.
Donnie Yen is in here as a blind swordsman. There's a lot of
Daredevil
samurai. Oh yeah, he was in Daredevil.
No. I'm saying like that character is Daredevil in this movie.
Oh, was he not in Daredevil?
I don't know. I'm just saying like he's a blind person that fights people. He's Daredevil in this movie.
There's a long history of injured samurai characters in Japanese cinema.
Okay.
So the armless swordsman, the legless swordsman, the blind swordsman. Zatoichi, the blind swordsman, is a very famous Japanese character that was in like a lot of fucking movies.
Yeah.
during the Japanese New Wave in the 60s and 70s. And there's a lot of like Kurosawa Seven Samurai kind of stuff here going, because she kind of collects these different rebels and these different kind of outsiders, mm-hmm. One of which Donnie Yen is one of them, but you also have Diego Luna, who's this kind of...
Her boyfriend?
he's supposed to be like this rebel who doesn't trust her, and there's supposed to be this question of her father, played by Mads Mikkelsen, whether he really left the Empire, or if he's still actually with them, and if he is, then should we trust her? None of this stuff really plays dramatically.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure why. I'm not sure if I was just in that bad of a mood and I was that tired, because I was nodding off. I didn't fall asleep, but I was nodding off for about the good first half of it, and I finally had to sit up straight and be like, okay, I have to, like, force myself to get into this movie.
Wow.
And I'm not sure why, just like, you know, Riz Ahmed plays a character, and he was in The Night Of on HBO, which a lot of people like. He played a really interesting character in Nightcrawler with Jake Gyllenhaal, so I really like him as an actor. Felicity Jones is great. I don't know why, you know, Diego Luna's a cool actor. I don't know why I could not get into this movie at all.
Because it doesn't matter what face you're looking at. If they've got nothing to say that's interesting or the action's not happening, then it's mm-hmm. like that. The actor they cast is irrelevant in this. It's so let me say
I agree.
That my boyfriend Cade really liked this movie because, okay, so spoilers, the whole premise of the movie is that her dad has actually created, while he was building the Death Star, he created this one fault where if you shoot the bomb into it just right, the whole Death Star will blow up. And so...
That's not a spoiler, because that's literally the ending of A New Hope.
That's right.
But yes.
But that's... But Cade really liked this movie because that's a plot line that has been made fun of in Star Wars... you know, trivia and stuff like that for decades, like since the movie came out. People are like, oh, really? Like, that's ridiculous that just this one little fault was able to... Well, here's the movie that actually plays out the reason why that happened, and it's because someone was working from the inside. And I think that is cool. I'm going to give them praise for that storyline, but the whole telling around it is just not interesting enough.
Well, I think, like I said with Moana, although I think it's much more severe here, you know, despite liking all of these actors, despite them having an interesting, you know, goal to attain, we never learn a single thing about them other than their thing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, other than what their little, like, character quirk is.
Right.
You know, Riz Ahmed especially completely wasted here. He almost has nothing to say in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Mads Mikkelsen has, like, one kind of emotional moment.
Yeah, I was going to...
In the movie.
Yeah, I was going to talk about that because I like... He does, like, you know, what is it called when they, like, film themselves and they're just like a hologram? And so he has this little monologue about the pain of losing his wife, because his wife did die when he got captured, and the pain of losing his wife and then never, you know, being able to see his daughter grow up, and that that pain is almost too bearable to go on, but that he keeps going and that takes its own strength. And I think that's really beautiful because this movie is like nuts. They're going to like seven planets and they're jumping around and going to these places and trying to get shit done and blowing up stuff. And then at the end of it, I mean, at the end of the day, you remember this monologue that he has and you go, oh my God, okay. So in a story about space and shit, it's still about the human experience. It's still about the familial bonds we have with the people that we love and we make our family. And that's, so I appreciate that that was included. That was its one saving grace for me.
Well, it was the one attempt to even do emotional storytelling here. And maybe that's a tall order for Star Wars, but there's also like, there's no like joy in this movie.
No.
Like there is in the other Star Wars movies.
Oh no, yeah. There's,
you know, and
it's very dark.
It's so dark and very dour. And I feel like I kind of got shades of like the later, Hunger Games movies in some of this, like, yeah, kind of that gritty sci-fi terrorism stuff.
Yeah. I think you're spot on with that. Yeah.
And I think that's what they were going for, and I think Felicity Jones is supposed to function a lot like a Katniss Everdeen as far as, like, what they were trying to sell. But she's not as interesting as even that, and I wouldn't say that Katniss Everdeen is that interesting on screen.
No.
If you're going for, like, this Seven Samurai Band of Misfits kind of thing, then fucking put in a Joss Whedon or somebody who can give these people some dialogue.
Yeah.
Who can give them a scene or two of kind of bouncing their personalities against each other in a fun way, or even in an interesting way.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give them props that because there's no sequel to this, this is a one-off.
Well, because everyone dies.
Exactly. The reason there is because it is a one-off.
Yeah.
If they knew that there was potential to sequelize this, they wouldn't have done that. But they made the decision that this would be the only version of this story.
I think that was
so because
smart,
of that.
Because there's no way these characters would have lived and gone on, but then not been in like A New Hope, Empire Strikes Back, and stuff. Because that exactly. This story is happening simultaneously to A New Hope. So there's no way they could have had these characters included, and so they just were like, all right, let's just trash all this at the end.
Yeah, and there's a ballsiness to that
right.
I appreciate.
Yeah.
And, you know, probably the ending, or the last little bit of it, is my favorite part of the movie because it was, you know, at one point when, like, over half the characters are dead, I was just like, Jesus Christ.
I know.
Like, yeah.
We're
really going to do this.
Yeah.
And the body count is ridiculous.
It's so sad.
Even before
like,
that
the
point.
Guy's like trying to give the flash drive to someone and he's like almost about to be choked out and so sad.
Oh, I guess we should talk about Darth Vader. He's in this.
Yeah, I was asleep for all the
no
time
effect.
That he was on the screen.
Yeah, and you're waiting a long time for it too. Like they've been building up to this, like partly because of the marketing campaign. They've been building up like, oh, you're going to see Darth Vader again. It'll be the first time he's been in a movie in a while. Mm-hmm. And then he really has not a lot to do. You know, he gets a couple fight sequences, but he's played pretty minimally in the movie, which is fine. I didn't need him to be the big bad again. I actually kind of like that he didn't focus on him.
Yeah, some people were upset that
there's
he wasn't.
There's a lot of the choices. Yeah. Well, I get because the marketing campaign
sure.
kind of tricked him into thinking he was.
Yeah.
But I there's a lot that I appreciate the choices they made in the movie narratively, but I don't think there's just, and maybe this is a Gareth Edwards problem because I felt very similarly about his Godzilla. I just don't give a damn
yes.
about any of these characters.
Exactly.
And so I was just I was insanely bored. Even though I was like, oh, this is dark. It's kind of interesting. I can see what they're going for. Some of these scenes work pretty well, you know, as action sequences. Except I will say towards the end when like the rebels come in all force, because, you know, at one point they have to deliver the, you know, the package or whatever
right.
themselves because everybody in the alliance is like, nope, it's a suicide mission. We're not doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, fine, we'll do it ourselves. And then at some point, the entire alliance is like, well, never mind, we'll go anyway. And then it just becomes this gigantic explosion fest and all this dogfighting and people
yeah.
are shooting everything. And at that point, maybe I was nodding off again, but I was like, why is this happening? Why is everybody just here flying around shooting each other right now?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I thought this was going to be like a little solo mission. Like, what's going on? Why? Like, literally, why is this happening? Yeah, I don't know. I part of me almost wants to see it again because now that I know the nuts and bolts of the story, I want to see how they were, like, what the whole point of it was. Like now that I know how it ends, I want to know, like, what I should have been paying attention to, because I just had no... It feels like the movie was happening despite an audience.
Like, yeah.
It did not have... There was no entry into the story. It was just kind of happening in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a weird coldness that I've never experienced in a Star Wars movie.
Yeah.
Even the shitty ones mm-hmm. are very aware of an audience and very aware of here's your hero and that and these kind of things. And, you know, maybe it's because John Williams didn't do the score and a lot of the success of Star Wars has to do with the music. I'm not sure, but this is like the most aloof
yeah.
Star Wars movie.
I think I agree when you said bring in a Joss Whedon who's going to give some life and some depth to these characters that's a little more playful or just not as heavy because the rest of the movie is so dark.
Right.
And
Whedon doesn't have a problem with killing off his characters.
Yeah, but he still does it in a way that makes you sad that they're dead, first of all. I mean, I don't mm-hmm. think I could sit through this movie again just because I know how it ends. So it's like, it's all, yes, they save the day. It's all a means to an end. So why bother? I don't know. I just felt like, is the storyline restricted because they have to fit it in exactly with this entire, like, other 7 movie saga? Like, I just mm-hmm. could not figure out why they could not make anything more interesting happening.
Yeah, it's a big missed opportunity, in my opinion, and especially given the kind of story they wanted to tell, which, you know, teases the idea of, like, character dynamics, but then never really does it.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I think it's kind of a love-hate experience is what I'm getting right now online, like, you know, reading as little about it as possible. I'm getting the idea that some people are all about it, really into it, really felt, you know, like they earned that ending. And then a lot of people, us included, are like,
what?
Not having it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's hard, right? Because, okay, so a little moment about me. When Twilight came out, I was an 18-year-old girl, and I saw the movie, and I loved it. Now, looking back, I'm like, oh my God, this is like nails on a chalkboard. Sometimes it is really bad and really awkward and you're like, how did I ever like this? It's because you're in the theater and you got the surround sound and you got the Coke and the popcorn. And I think a lot of people's perceptions, especially fans of Star Wars, already go in there ready to have the time of their lives. And they're so committed to liking it already. So that's just some kind of head game that they go into. And so for someone like me, like I enjoy Empire Strikes Back or whatever, but I've never been that moved by Star Wars. It's just like not exactly my thing. And
right.
And so for this movie, I was like willing to give it a shot. I was like, oh, it's, you know, it's a Star Wars franchise movie. It should be fun. There should be some good action. Nope. So I think I was just really flabbergasted. But yeah, the fans are going to go in there and have that surround sound and those 3D glasses. Glasses on, and they're gonna have the time of their lives because no matter what, they've already committed to having the time of their lives.
Yeah, there's always a contingent of that whenever you see a major property like this. There, in some ways, some of these things are critic proof.
Yeah.
And certainly with this movie, I think that will be the case. It's with these kind of movies, you never can really get a full scale of like how successful it was as a story until a good 10 years later.
Yeah, you know, that's what I'm curious to see is like, how will fans feel about this 5 years from now when they go back to watch it? Are they really going to care that much? Or are they going to be like, wow, you know, this isn't the fun one to watch. I'd rather watch, you know, A New Hope or something like that instead.
Yeah, no, I think you're spot on with that for sure. So, yeah, I don't know. It's there. it feels kind of like it didn't retcon anything too big. I have seen some articles written about, like, this changes everything in Star Wars now.
No, it doesn't.
For the better or the worse. Nah, I think it's there. It doesn't do anything. It's not as bad or as egregious as the prequels as far as retconning goes. But,
what do you mean by retcon? What's that mean?
Retroactive continuity.
Oh, it gotcha.
It means when a creator goes back and fiddles with their mythology and says, actually, the reason this happens is because they were clones of Jango Fett.
Which is exactly... Which is all that George Lucas does in Star Wars is try to fiddle and go back and add CGI to 1970s movies and tear shit up.
Awful. Right, exactly. Okay, so last but not least, I want to talk a little bit about, we don't have a proper Netflix review.
Sure.
But I want to talk a little bit about what are we watching on Netflix. And there's a show that you've been trying to get me to watch, and I can never remember what it's called. You should text it to me. What is it? What is it?
Oh my gosh, it's Lovesick.
And what is Lovesick?
Lovesick. So it's a British kind of rom-com. What's it called? A Britcom? That's what it's called. So it's a Netflix original. It's a Britcom. So it takes place in outside of London or maybe in the city. Not quite sure, but it's about these three friends who are in their, 20 somethings, late 20 somethings. And it used to be called Scrotal Recall, which that's just like a terrible play on words. And it actually, they had to have the title changed because people weren't getting into this show because they look at it and say, Scrotal Recall? What the hell? So they changed it to Lovesick, which I think is still like a little too simple for me. So they went like way safe after Scrotal Recall filmed. Okay, so it's about these three 20-somethings living in the UK, and the kind of lead male character, his name is Dylan. He, mm-hmm. in the first episode, he finds out that he has... he's gotten chlamydia from having a sexual partner.
Right.
So he obviously...
the most popular way of catching chlamydia.
Yeah. So he's got chlamydia. He takes some antibiotics to get rid of it. But the person at the clinic does recommend that he calls all of his previous lovers to ask them to get checked and make sure that, that doesn't happen. So the whole show is about him working through the list of his lovers in alphabetical order. So each episode is the name of one of the people that he's had sex with. So Abigail, Phoebe, Anna. So.
Oh, okay.
Which is kind of fun.
Me and Cade watched all of the digital shorts for that show, High Maintenance.
Yeah.
And that has a similar kind of structure where the overall premise is that it's about a drug dealer who deals pot to these like New Yorkers, but every episode is named after the person he's going to.
Yeah.
And it has more to do with them and their lives than it has to do with the main character.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. So the I like that idea, that format. And so I like the format of this show because it's going to focus on this woman named Abigail. Okay. So we go in and suddenly it takes us, it jumps around in the timeline because it covers their friendship, these three people. So there's Dylan, Luke, and Evie. And it covers their timeline as friends for a period of over 7 years. And it's able to do that really quickly and cover all of that ground to get these characters really well-rounded in just a short amount of time because you're jumping around in the timeline so much based on whenever he slept with whatever woman it is that the episode is about.
Okay, and it's still continuing, the show?
Yeah, they just put out season 2, and it's definitely... The season 1 ends on a cliffhanger, so luckily, if you're listening to this now and you want to see it, you don't have to wait because season 2 is out. And I'm anxiously awaiting season 3 because there's only like 6 episodes in each season. So it's easily binge watchable and you can just pick it up real quick. And it's totally, I think it's hilarious. It's not like a typical sitcom where there's, the stupid little one liners that are supposed to be a joke, like Friends or something.
Right.
It really relies on the relationships that Dylan has with his two friends, Luke and Evie. And his whole relationship with Evie specifically, because he's in love with her and she's really in love with him. But he's like so wrapped up in the mess of all of these different women that he's dating and having sex with. And she just kind of is like a faithful wingman the whole time, mm-hmm. even though you can mm-hmm. totally see the pain behind her eyes that they both want to be okay. together.
So is it and how many episodes are in each season?
Like 6 episodes. So it's really easy. I mean, when season 2 came out, I was like so excited. And then I watched it all in a couple of hours and then was sad again. It's now I don't have anywhere to watch.
Yeah. I was gonna say, like, if they're, like, you know, 20 episode seasons, then, like, this Dylan guy's really slutty.
No.
Okay, that I'm more interested now than I was when you were just telling me to watch some show.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I try to.
For some reason in my head, I thought it was more like a straight sitcom. Like, it was just like
no.
Blue Mountain, whatever. You know what I'm talking
about? Blue Mountain State.
Yeah, I thought it was like that.
No.
I don't know.
No. It's really just, I don't know. I just really like the humor in it. The comedy is so genuine, and it's because it just relies on who the characters are, not these stupid one-liners.
Okay, cool. The show I watched, which they just recently added to the Netflix queue, is called Hip Hop Evolution. It's a documentary series that covers the early stages of the hip hop movement, where it originates in Brooklyn, New York, and how it evolves out of there, later Southern California. It's a Canadian series that was, done by Banger Films, which they generally cover heavy metal stuff. They did a heavy metal journey, which is like a documentary they did back in the early 2000s, and then they had a kind of a spin-off series of that called Metal Evolution, which I think this show kind of aims to be the hip-hop version of it. So they kind of, you know, each episode kind of covers a different thing. So the first one is like how, you know, in the 70s, this was a style of music that was really bred out of dance and disco, and people who were just avid record collectors, and they figured out this way that if they put two of the same record on a turntable, then they can actually continuously loop, and then
that sounds like the entire premise of like The Get Down, that new Baz Luhrmann Netflix show.
Which I haven't watched yet. I've heard it's good.
But yeah, it takes place in the 70s, and it's all about them creating that sound with the two records. Anyway, go on.
Mm-hmm. So this talks about a lot of the bigger movers and shakers, during that scene. And for a long time, hip-hop, and this is stuff I learned watching. For a long time, it didn't even, there was no recorded history. I mean, other than, like, live recordings at clubs and stuff, and some of, like, the, challenges or competitions they would have that would end up being taped on the decks as they were doing it. There was none of these people were being signed. There was like no hits really. There was no singles. It was very much a dance club culture kind of thing. The next episode kind of goes into how it becomes a record label sort of hit oriented thing. Then the next episode kind of goes into the golden age of like Run DMC and the Beastie Boys and LL Cool J and that kind of thing. And then the next episode goes into, the LA thing, like the Southern California gangster rap NWA thing. And it's only four episodes so far. You can kind of get the feeling this is a trial season. How interested are people really?
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was really illuminating and enlightening and very comprehensive. I think all of the different footage they show, both some of the stuff that they've been able, that people have had on archived for years and have never shown before, have never been put together in this sort of way, is really useful. There's some animation that's added in for effect and, some good look at like how, you know, New York in particular has changed over the decades and how the look of hip hop has changed. You know, people kind of think of it now as this very sort of urban street gang oriented kind of look and aesthetic. But at a point, if you go back to the 70s, it was people who looked like George Clinton, Parliament, Funkadelic with the crazy like Christmas tree hats and, you know, giant light up goggles. And, you know, they wanted to look like space aliens. It was a totally different kind of thing.
Right.
So I really enjoyed it a lot. This is my bread and butter, this kind of, you know, classification and categorization of music subgenres. I kind of get off on this.
That's so
maybe this is made just for me in particular.
Yeah.
But I really liked it. And I think that people should check it out. And I would like to see further seasons. It kind of ends abruptly after the fourth episode, you know, talking about, you know, it ends at about where, Dr. Dre releases The Chronic in 91 or 2.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously there's so much that's happened since then. So I would really like to see how they cover, you know, like the Bad Boy era or, You know, the Atlanta hip hop era of like the early 2000s and whatever. So I'm into it.
Yeah, I think that's cool. I think if you're looking for something on Netflix and you're, you know, just a simple comedy isn't going to do it for you. I think you never go wrong with watching something historical where you can actually learn something and take it with you and kind of have that little bit of trivia to tell your friends about. I think it's a it's a good way to spend your time.
It's presented in a very entertaining way, and the documentary subjects that you know they're able to get, Chuck D, Curtis Blow, all these like old hip hop guys are very candid, and there's a lot of ego there still. You know, some of these like competitions and these like rivalries, you know, still they go on to these about them like competing in who was the best rap group in 1981. They'll still argue for their case, but it's fun and light, and I think that there is some, obviously there's right now there seems to be something in the zeitgeist about sort of figuring out this history, the sort of invisible history, because there's that show you were mentioning, the Baz Luhrmann one, of course, the NWA movie that came out last year, Straight Outta Compton, and so I think there are people right now are really trying to wrap their head around this stuff because as a culture it was ignored for so long.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's the show.
Yeah.
And thanks for coming on.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Before I read off my big list of junk, what do you have a Twitter? Do you have a Tumblr? what do you want people to follow you if you want them to follow you?
I'm not on Twitter much, but it's Ashley Hitchcock, all one word. And it's two E's, A-S-H-L-E-E. And then Hitchcock, like Alfred Hitchcock, the director. But mostly I'm on my Instagram. That's where you can really see what I'm up to. And if you want to follow me there, you're more than welcome to.
Same handle?
Yep, same handle. Ashley Hitchcock.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And I'm on Twitter as well, at BC Cassidy. You can also follow the show at Jabber Podcast. If you want to leave an email for us or you have anything to say about anything we talked about today, you can do that at jabberandthedrone@gmail.com. You can find us and subscribe to the show at iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Player.fm, Pocket Cast, the Windows Podcast Network, and now we are on Google Play. You can read the movie reviews that I do weekly for the Idaho State Journal at my archives, saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. I've provided some content for the Seattle-based website MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. Now I have to turn in to them by the end of the month my top 10 of the year, in which I've seen hardly any movies this year.
Oh, this year was shit for movies.
I think so, too. But I wrote a list down of everything I want to see in the next 10 days, and it's going to be tough.
Oh, yeah.
There's like 11 movies that I still need to see before I feel like I can give them an opinion, a well-informed top 10.
Yeah, I'll be curious to read that.
Brad, friend of the show, he has a blog that he maintains at medium.com/panel-frame. Friends of the show, Rod and Denise, you should go listen to their music podcast, The Listening Party. I think they just released an episode yesterday, their holiday episode. And friend of the show, Patrick, be sure to go check out his two podcasts, Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational. That's all we have for you today, and hopefully we'll be able to get you some more, December award season reviews. By the end of the month.
Yeah, happy holidays.
Bye.
Bye.